At the stroke of midnight, one country becomes two. Families are split. Millions of people uprooted. Countless die. Villages are divided and enemies are born. All due to the stroke of a pen. Lines on a map. I'm Jerry Brotton, a map historian, and welcome to What's Your Map? An Oculi Mundi exploration. In this series, we speak to people who live, love, and work with maps, making, preserving, interpreting, and being inspired by them. In each episode, we ask our guests to unfold a map that is special to them and to tell us the story that lies behind it. To follow the map as we talk about it on this podcast, go to oculi-mundi.com. Our guest on today's episode of What's Your Map was born to Punjabi immigrant parents in Wolverhampton. He entered the state education system unable to speak English, yet went on to study at Cambridge, and is now one of the UK's leading public intellectuals. Satnam Sangare is a best-selling and internationally acclaimed writer of memoir, history, fiction and children's books, an award-winning journalist and a broadcaster, presenting various TV and radio programmes. He's a fellow of both the Royal Society of Literature and the Royal Historical Society and was named as one of GQ magazine's Men of the Next 25 Years in 2013, my favourite of all his accolades. His memoir, The Boy with the Top Knot, was adapted as a BBC drama, and he's written many other books, including Empireland and his latest, Empire World, on the enduring influence of Britain's imperial past across the globe. Satnam, welcome to What's Your Map?
Thank you. It's always nice to hear your obituary.
Somebody once said that to me as well. Thanks for that obituary. Tell me, what map are we looking at today?
Actually, just having a map makes me nostalgic for the pre-SatNav days. But we've got a map here of India from 1948. That should spark some thought in people's minds. Yeah. I mean, this is, according to the title, it's a map showing the progress of political reorganization of states. So you've got various Indian states marked out, like Bihar and Bhutan and Sindh and Hyderabad and Jammu and Kashmir and so on. But of course, you will notice there's a slightly erratic green line over two corners of India.
So this looks to my eyes as a quite scientific objective map, as you're saying. It's got scale, it's got references in the corner, you've got this title, and yet you do have clearly what are political divisions. And we are effectively, are we not, looking at a map of the partition of India in 1947. This is 1948. And just try and sort of give us a sense of the story of partition based on what we're looking at with the map here, Satnam.
Yeah, I mean, the odd thing for me looking at this map is that, you know, I have spent a quarter or half my life writing about many of these areas like Tibet and Punjab and Kashmir, and yeah, I very rarely look at the map, and I, in my head, I can't connect that. I actually didn't realize they were connected up in this way.
In what
sense? It's a bit like the tube map, you know.
Yeah.
You know London from the tube, but then you can't connect the physical geography to the tube map. I feel a bit like that. I can't connect what I know about the areas to how they're actually physically next to each other.
Well, also, I
didn't realize Tibet was that close.
Well, I also look at it and think, obviously, what we're looking at is, how to say, older-fashioned terms for areas in India, which, of course, are part of the imperial English-British history and legacy here. And that's, I guess, what surprises me as well. And we're going to talk about your heritage, because you are connected to this and are not connected to it. It must be weird. There must be an odd effect that it has, as you're saying, that you know it, but you don't know it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, my parents are Punjabi. They're from near Jalandhar. Jalandhar is marked out, and it's a big industrial city.
In the Punjab.
The Punjab. I always see it as India's equivalent of Wolverhampton, where I grew up.
Yeah.
It's very industrial and polluted.
Yeah.
But it says, this map says that it's in East Punjab, and there's a West Punjab. Those are terms I've just never come across before. I mean, we talk about ourselves as Punjabi, but of course, there was, because of this reorganization, there was suddenly a West Punjab and an East Punjab.
And the map, and it's a British colonial mapmaker who is dividing up India at this point in 1947, we're going to talk about him, is drawing these divisions, which is fascinating to hear you say, well, I understand a term of Punjab, but here is East Punjab and West Punjab, and then there's Bengal and there's East Bengal.
Interestingly, though, the words Pakistan appear twice. And actually, you could barely read them because they're so half-hearted. But I guess it's just beginning to be a country. So there's Pakistan on the left and there's an East Pakistan on the right.
Let's take a closer look at the map Satnam has brought us. It's an explosion of colour, with bright pink, yellow and purple, showing the different territories of India and the newly created country of Pakistan. Dated 1948, the map was part of the white paper that went before the newly formed Indian government that acted as the official record of not only independence from British rule, but partition. This map captures a momentous and catastrophic moment from the previous year, 1947, when Britain ended its colonial rule in India and carved up the country. Cast your eyes to the stipple green lines to the right of the map, and you see this area is called Pakistan. Bordering Burma, West Bengal, and with Dhaka at its heart, the holy Ganges River flows through these lands and out into the Bay of Bengal. But turn your eyes to the left of the map, traversing 1,000 miles past Bihar, Rajasthan and New Delhi, and you'll find another Pakistan separated from India by another green dotted line. Here you'll find the ancient cities of Karachi and Lahore, and to the north of this new Pakistan lies Jammu and Kashmir, territory given to India. The architect of this division was the British colonial government. In particular, one man, Cyril Radcliffe, a barrister who was given just 5 weeks to cut India into two countries. All he had for reference were outdated maps and old census reports, and the resulting divide, the green stippled lines on this map, was called the Radcliffe Line. Villages were left divided and millions displaced as Pakistan in the west and Pakistan in the east became a predominantly Muslim country. An estimated 17 million people were uprooted. Violence erupted between Sikhs, Hindus, and Muslims. Wars followed. More blood was spilt, and East Pakistan now exists as Bangladesh, while conflict continues in Jammu and Kashmir. Saddam, why is the British Empire doing this in 1947? What is the need that they feel this kind of partition of India is needed for?
Basically, they're bankrupt. And secondly, India is getting more and more unstable. There's violence between Muslims and Hindus, and they can't really keep it all together anymore, so they need to get out fast in their heads.
And is it Mountbatten who makes that sudden decision to say, the answer here is to create lines on a map which somehow divide Hindus from Muslims?
I don't think it was one particular person. It was one of the people consulted, weirdly, in the build-up of this was Enoch Powell, who wrote a big report about India, about what should be done. And he felt it could be kept together, it could continue being a British colony. He wrote a report for Winston Churchill.
I didn't know about Powell. This is extraordinary. So yeah. Powell actually argued for unified India.
Yeah, and it was, his report was so mad that even Winston Churchill was like, is Enoch okay? Because, you know, obviously we can't stay.
Wow. I didn't realise that.
For him, Enoch Powell's ultimate ambition was always to be Viceroy of India. That's what his whole career had been building up to. So for him, handing Indian independence was a major personal catastrophe.
I don't know how many people are listening will actually know the granular history of what's gone on here.
Absolutely, they don't. And I think this is reflected in, actually, weirdly, Indian curry houses, because people go to curry houses thinking the food is cooked by Indians. But of course, it's mostly Bangladeshis, right?
Yeah.
And in the British imagination, India is just one place. But you look at this map and the sheer diversity of the places and the characters and the religions and the cultures. And then for someone to draw a line randomly, seemingly or erratically, someone who's actually never visited India before, it's just incredible that this happened. I mean, it was Aisha Jahal said that partition was the central historical event of 20th century South Asia. And looking at this map, you realise, what a massive thing it was to do.
You were of Sikh heritage, and this is incredibly complicated, right? Because you, again, people often think about this as a division that the British Empire enacts between Muslims and Hindus, but it's not that simple, is it?
No, the Sikhs, I mean, are a minority in India and everywhere, actually. I mean, they compete to be something like the fifth or sixth biggest religion in the world. So not that big. But obviously, Hindus were hugely affected, Muslims were hugely affected, but Sikhs were affected per capita more than any other group because they were living both in West Punjab and East Punjab. So suddenly, with their partition, half of their heritage was over the line in Pakistan. So they moved in disproportionate numbers into India. And so it's a defining event for Sikhs. It shaped them in so many ways. My parents have never seen the Sikh temples on the Pakistan side of Punjab. But also it supercharged, I would say, the Islamophobia in the Sikh community. It also supercharged our community's desire to migrate. I think Sikhs have always migrated in large numbers, but because so many moved with partition, they just carried on, I think. And then there's just the memories of violence and, you know, it's often compared to the Holocaust, and I think you shouldn't make that kind of comparison easily, but the sheer numbers.
I mean, the numbers with a line drawn on a map of deaths and displacement, I mean, is almost too much to comprehend. I mean, people estimate around 1 million people died.
Well, this is the thing. I always find this very interesting. I read estimates saying that between 500,000 and 2 million people died. Just the variation on the numbers says something. Just because when British people died, often the numbers were measured quite precisely, often to the precise number. Whereas when Indians died,
we can't do it by a million.
We have we're out by 1 million and a half. How do you lose 1.5 million people? And it says something in itself about the lack of care that was taken.
And this doesn't even cover what this dividing line on a map does in terms of people being displaced, mass migration, you know, levels of poverty, you know, levels of, you know, just malnutrition. I mean, the impact is in the tens of millions that a colonial administrator decides to draw a line. And the impact that that has is utterly cataclysmic.
Yeah, no, 15 million people displaced. But then you've got individual things like the story of Kashmir.
So the Kashmir, we see up here.
Again, that's something I've always struggled to in my head to locate Kashmir in India. But, you know, it's talked about, Kashmir is talked about in the literature I've been reading, going back like centuries, as one of the most beautiful places in the world. And again, I can't visit it. You can't really visit it. It's a very dangerous area because it's contested between Pakistan and India. The defining thing about the Punjab is the rivers, because Punjab means five rivers. And actually the word punch also has a link there, because P-U-N, five ingredients in punch, hence the word punch.
Had you just got that? Have you just decided on that?
Or no, that's the thing.
It's a thing. I didn't know that.
And the other thing that actually really comes home with this is how landlocked the Punjab is. And I was, you know, I can't swim. I'm not that, I expect you to know that. And I think it's because not only am I from the landlocked West Midlands, but also my heritage is from the landlocked India. You know, basically, it's so in the middle of the subcontinent, isn't it? It's very, very far from the sea. Flying into India, we would always fly into Delhi, and then there'd be a very long journey to Jalandhar, which is near the village where my father was born. He was born in Belga.
Northwest of Delhi here on the map, yeah.
And then, in my head, that journey would take 5 days, but actually it's probably 3 hours. Well, it's probably 3 hours in car now. But I also remember, you know, when I was very young, when I was four, doing the journey from my father's village to Amritsar, the holy city, in an oxen cart. That took 2 days.
Wow.
And that was in 1980s.
Wow.
And now it's a highway, of course.
And then just over here, across, as it were, the border is Lahore.
Yeah, and not very far away is Lahore. Yeah. And in my imagination, Lahore is like a flight away, but it's not. You could probably cycle there. I mean, I don't know, cycle. You could drive there very quickly.
And then just to the north, Kashmir again.
And then you've got the Kashmir, which is such a central part of the Sikh imagination, you know, and it's said to famous people always go on, or historians go on about how it contains not only the most beautiful waterfalls and valleys, but also is home to the most beautiful women in the world. I think there's probably several parts of the world that have been described like that.
Many parts.
But I've never been there.
It just strikes me that everything from the sort of central provinces down to the south here, down to Goa, are not really part of the contestation here around partition. Of course, Goa, infamously, remains part of the Portuguese Empire.
Yeah, and it's coloured purple. Is that why it's called? Goa's always been administrated slightly differently. Why is it purple?
Because it's foreign territories within India.
So even then it was governed by...
Yeah.
And this is the complexity that actually you and I, it took me several years to understand, that the British India was very, very complicated. There are parts of India that the British governed directly, the other parts that were governed by princes or kings on their behalf. And then there were even bits that were foreign. Again, not very well understood by British people.
And I went to Goa, I think, in the late 90s and was shocked to realise that there were Catholic cathedrals and you'd hear the sound of singing in an Indian voice. I remember it just completely blew me away because it was Portuguese Catholic.
And you got your Pondicherry, French?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and there's such huge diversity. India is very much not one thing. I can't imagine how many times the size of Britain India is, but it's many, 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 many times.
Before we continue, I just want to say to our listeners, I'm so pleased you're joining me as I explore the world of maps, their stories, and the people who love them. If you're enjoying this podcast, and if you don't want to miss a future episode, then please do consider subscribing and leaving a review when you finish listening. We always need to remember with maps, it's always look at the margins, look at the titles and also look at the margins. And at the bottom, can you see?
Yeah, it says published under the authority of Brigadier G.F. Heaney, CBE, Surveyor of General of India. I mean, I don't know a huge amount of maps. Obviously, you're a world expert. I didn't realise until last year that maps and geography were such a core part of colonialism. I didn't realise that geography was basically a colonial subject.
I mean, it's invented. Halford Mackinder, who is the chair of geography at Oxford, and you now have the Mackinder chair in geography, he invented the term geopolitics. I mean, he was a right-wing pro-imperialist figure who, you know, in the 1920s was a member of parliament. He pretty much invented this whole idea, you know, said the idea of the geographical pivot. If you control Eurasia, you control everywhere. And it's still being played out. So all the hawks in Washington use those ideas. And the geography as a discipline was absolutely hardwired to imperial British politics in the late 19th century.
I also recently learned that actually geography was taught as a subject way before history in Britain. You learnt about the British Empire through geography.
Absolutely, because the sun never sets. It's all the pink bits, right?
Yeah.
And this is a map which I guess is at the beginning of that twilight of that empire. But you do have this figure, Heaney. He's the last Surveyor General of India. Mm. And he has a big civil service role as mapping India. The mapping of India in the 19th century is a huge part of the imperial administration. And here you have this way in which we should talk a bit about Cyril Radcliffe, this extraordinary figure who in 1947 is sent out by the Brits to map this entire subcontinent almost, I mean, beyond the country. Tell me a little bit about Radcliffe and what you know about that.
Well, actually, I think in your annoyingly best-selling book, History of the World in 12 Maps, you summarise very efficiently the problems with Sir Cyril Radcliffe. His title was what? He was a former Director General of the Ministry of Information. So the problems with him drawing this line were, first of all, he'd never been to India before. Secondly, he did it in just 3 months. And this is a 6,000-kilometre geographical boundary dividing 90 million people. He commissioned no new geographic surveys.
This is kind of extraordinary. You know, he's literally in his office in London playing around with maps. He doesn't actually survey or try to survey the country. And it's a sign, isn't it, of that imperial mindset, say, quick, we've made a political decision, we're going to partition the country between India and Pakistan, and we're going to get the heck out of there.
Quickly, yeah, because things are going wrong. Yeah. But then on top of it, they didn't announce their decisions in a newspaper of multiple newspapers, they put up posters. I find that incredible. Yeah. I was looking up before I came here that actually it's hard to get official maps that he used, and he probably destroyed them, I'm guessing. And actually, this is what the British did routinely. I used to resist this explanation because you sound like a conspiracy theorist, but there was said to be a pall of smoke over Delhi as the British left because they were destroying so much documentation. And this comes up again and again, the history of British Empire. I mean, the two men who were involved in setting up Nigeria routinely destroyed their documentation. They kind of knew that history would not judge them well. I suspect Radcliffe knew this would not go down well.
We know
with
that,
historians.
And we know this from the late 19th century accounts of the colonial administrative offices in London would just destroy. They'd rip up, they'd burn early East India Company office records. It's hard for us to tell a story about the early East India Company because there's nothing left. It was just destroyed.
And it goes on because the final Viscount of India, Mountbatten, I mean, it's a regular story in the papers. His papers, lots of them are still secret. And no one really knows why. And there's a campaign by one particular historian, I think, to release the papers. But isn't that incredible? Because this is one of the biggest events in global history. And we still haven't got his papers properly. I mean, we need to understand. India needs to understand what happened. And Pakistan does. And I find that incredible. And this is what the British state always did. Protected itself.
And things like the maps, which are so central to that imperial state, they not only control politics, but they create people's identities, right? Because you start naming these areas and you start saying, well, we're not going to call this area this anymore. We're going to call it something else. We're going to say, you know, Burma, or we're going to give names like Calcutta. The way in which names, of course, change are very powerful for people's sense of their identity. And this is very much what the mapping is doing here, isn't it? Because the legacy from 47, 48 onwards, I mean, he's still very much with us.
Yeah, and it echoes what the British did in terms of organising people. What they did, they put them into crude categories. So they saw the caste system and they made it much more binary than it was in reality. They created much firmer categories than there were in reality. And now their lines or the way they regulated the castes are still used by Indians to allocate jobs, for example. So they permanently changed the way people were organized by caste. They also organized people by religion in a much more basic way than maybe Indians did by themselves. I mean, one of the ultimate tragedies of partition is that in the Punjab is that you had villages like my parents where people, Muslims and Sikhs and Hindus, had lived side by side for centuries, in some cases millennia. And suddenly they become Muslim majority or Sikh majority or Hindu majority. They become much more binary places. And that is one of the great legacies of the British Empire, I think. It created a lot of division that didn't previously exist there. Almost every colony that the British got involved with, they classified people in very basic ways. And this was done through anthropologists, but also through maps and lines on maps.
I wonder, Satnam, I mean, this is now starting to think about the work that you've done around the legacy of empire in your books, in Empire Land and Empire World. What is it there? Is this a sort of a desire to impose national mapped boundaries? Is it about the obsession that the British Empire has with some idea of a nation state? So you create somewhere called West Pakistan and East Pakistan. And these are, of course, imported Western ideas about the nation state, which they don't fit when people have different forms of language or religion or caste or so many different ways in which they categorise each other. Is it about imposing these rigid national lines? What is it? Why it's been so disastrous?
Yeah, it's a lack of nuance, isn't it? And if you don't live amongst the people, you don't get the nuances. And it continues in the way in which we talk about the British Empire, in the way the debate is very unnuanced. It's either you could talk about whether the British Empire was good or bad. It's very rarely said that actually it was both things. Or, you know, the grey areas get very little publicity. But it goes into almost every aspect of the British Empire. Like when it came to things like sexuality, the British often didn't understand what was going on. In that there's fluidity of sexuality and gender, and then they would do things like try to ban homosexuality, and that legacy continues. I mean, the British Empire is responsible or the cause of, even today, most homophobic anti-gay legislation around the world because of their very basic ideas about people. But it went on into the way they thought people practiced their religion and caste and so on.
Both the books Empire Land and Empire World have had a huge uptake. I mean, you know, huge debates around them, you know, people have responded so powerfully to it. Obviously, there's also been a lot of pushback. What is the problem around acknowledging the history of the British Empire and the legacy? And as you've said, in Empire World, I mean, you people read it, I've read it, and it's about looking for nuance. It's to say there are positives, there are negatives, but we need to understand our own history through that longer history because we need to come to terms with that. What is the problem? Why are people so, I guess I'd sort of say, you know, provoked, angry about it? It seems surprising to me, but what for you has it done? Why has it generated such passionate responses?
I think there's lots of different reasons, but one of the main ones is I think lots of British people have family histories going back to Empire. And if you say, oh, there were genocides, they assume you mean that you're calling their grandfather a genocidal racist. You aren't necessarily, because there were good people in the British Empire and bad people and so on. But they take it very, very personally. It gets very personal quite quickly. And also, other thing, it very quickly becomes a conversation about race. Because generally, it was white people conquering brown and black people. And when you, as soon as you add race to any conversation, it gets explosive. And people get het up on both sides. So it gets very, very emotional very quickly. And the other thing is, people just don't understand it. So if you turn up and you say, actually, you're wrong, what you thought was wrong, you sometimes are challenging people's very sense of identity, of their place in the world. And that can be really destabilizing for them.
I wanted to ask you about your relationship to this map and your own heritage. You know, being of Sikh heritage, being born in Wolverhampton, you know, you are of this map and you're not of this map. I'm just curious at what it evokes. Or when you look at it, where are you going? Are you looking at where your family comes from?
Yeah, that's right. So I'm looking at Jalandhar. And I always never quite understand when you go there how close you are to the Pakistan border. Because I've never actually been to the Pakistan border. So I go to Amritsar, which is the Sikh holy city, go to Jalandhar, I go to Delhi. And you don't have a sense there of how close you are to another country. It also makes me very melancholic because I've spent half my life reading about Lahore and the Sikh Empire, which covered, you know, an area way into Pakistan, into the Afghanistan and so on, and Kashmir. And I've never been there.
You've never been. I mean, that's quite extraordinary. That really the consequences of drawing these lines means that you cannot go there.
Yeah, not only that, my mom, who's deeply, deeply religious, you know, has never seen, you know, some of the temples associated with our founder. And not only that, if we went, it'd be difficult to get a visa for India ever again, and vice versa. They make it very, very difficult because there's so much tension. And I feel so sad about Kashmir. And Kashmir is actually the name of my favorite uncle, late uncle. And I've read so much stuff about how beautiful it is. And it makes me so sad that I can't really go there. Although I said that at an event, and a proud Modi supporter said, "Shut up, you can go there whenever you like." Although, when you fill out the visa forms, it asks you very carefully. You probably fill these out whether you've ever been, and you know it's going to be difficult if you admit you've been there. But I just really would quite like to see it. I'd love to see Lahore, but I know I've got Pakistani friends of mine who are journalists, who struggle to get ever into India, BBC journalists who just cannot get into India. That's amazing that happens in the modern world.
Emotively, what does that do for you? Is there an anger? Is there an anguish? Is there a sort of longing for that? What does it inspire in you?
It's deep melancholy. It's really sad. It's very sad. One of the legacies of partition is the Sikh search for a nation state and identity, and the Khalistanis and the way the Khalistanis have been repressed. And so the struggle goes on.
T- Tell me more about that, because I don't know very much about that in terms of the Khalistani and that conflict. Tell me more.
Well, it's just, I mean, to be basic about it, I mean, the Sikhs, you know, quite a small community, they feel vulnerable, you know, and they've always generally been based in that part of the world, and lots of Sikhs feel like they should have their own state, so they call it Khalistan.
As a kid, did you feel that you identified as Indian or Sikh? What were those different? And obviously, you were British, so what were your kind of conflicted feelings there, or were they? How did you put them all together?
I don't think I did. I think it was a bunch of contradictions, and it changed. I mean, I remember going to school and not being able to speak English. I remember being able to speak English and speaking with a very heavy Punjabi accent, heavy, really heavy. And then I remember speaking with a very heavy Black Country accent. And now I speak like this. I feel like I've been through many phases, but I think at the age of 48, I feel mainly like a Londoner, you know? And I think if you're from London, you kind of...
That's why we're in London.
But yeah. Increasingly also, I feel very attached to Wolverhampton as well.
Satnam Sangeri, thank you so much for joining me on What's Your Map?
My pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening. I'm Jerry Broughton, and this has been What's Your Map? Why not continue your exploration of the wonderful world of maps by subscribing? That way, you'll never miss an episode. You can also read more about the Sunderland Collection, find all the episodes and maps from this podcast, and send us suggestions for other maps to explore at oculi-mundi.com. This has been an Oculi Mundi exploration. The producer is Emily Uchida Finch, and it's a Whistledown production.